I'm Jan Suk Fong Lee.
And I'm Dina Del Bucchia.
And this is Can't Lit. Can't Lit.
Talk about books and stuff. Hello, and welcome to Can't Lit. I'm having a day.
We're all having a day.
It is a real day and a half. It's the middle of November, everyone's favorite time of year. Just kidding. If you hate this, you're the worst. We have a very special guest today.
The most special.
Would you say a top shelf guest?
Oh, yeah.
Top shelf, top drawer.
Yeah, like the top, top shelf where the best whiskey is kept.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Keith Millard, how are you?
I'm not too bad.
You're in Jen's home. Rosie responded mostly positively to you.
Mostly, although she barked when I first came in the door.
Yes, but it took her, what, 20 minutes to warm up?
About 20 minutes, and she's finally warmed up. She sniffed the cat hairs on my pants, and she's now calm. She likes cats.
She does like cats, and, you know, 20 minutes is pretty good, because there are some people that she doesn't like upon repeated and, like, sustained contact.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Sean Cranberry.
This is a new segment. It's called, Does Rosie Still Hate Sean Cranberry? And what is the answer?
I think she's... Yes.
What's the progress?
There's slight progress.
Okay, great.
But it's not great progress.
Great.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what's happening. Jen, do you want to start?
Yeah, what's happening? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a cold, and I've had this cold for about 7 or 8 weeks now. And we, Dina and I, were just hosting the launch of Refuse, of which Keith is a contributor, and he was there too. So we were all just together like 3 days ago.
That's right.
Very good week.
Yeah, it's been a very good week. And I felt okay. And then when I was introducing Keith, my voice started to go and I started to cough a little bit. And like, was it emotion? Was it the virus? Who knows? But Sanara Geisler, friend of the podcast, former guest.
Former guest, friend of the podcast.
Ran up and gave me some fisherman's friends and saved the day.
And we got some water and...
Yeah, we got some water. And then I had to exit at some point and cough in the bathroom by myself. I mean, and that day was just a real day. And then the next day, Rosie projectile vomited all over me in the car. And it was just... The last few days have been a real treat.
And last week...
Last week.
She pooped on someone's bed.
She pooped on Chelsea Rooney's bed.
Friend of the podcast. Podcast.
Like, Chelsea came out of her bedroom. She's like, I don't want to alarm you. There is a poop on my bed. And I'm like, she's like, I'm pretty sure it's not yours. Like, could be. I mean, it could be.
If it's your dog's, it's yours.
I mean, who
that's
even
how,
knows?
That's how we claim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she pooped on Chelsea's bed. Otherwise, had a very good time there. It was pretty well behaved.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Well behaved dog. I feel like the launch was really enjoyable.
The launch was good. I think there were a lot of people. Keith and I were talking that maybe 80 people. What do you think, Dina?
It was standing room only.
Mm-hmm.
All the way down to sitting on the heat registers.
Yeah, it did. It was quite warm in that room.
Yeah, I didn't notice because I was shivering with like the like viral sweats.
You were sweating through your velvet dress.
Everyone was very well dressed. It was a good looking crowd.
Everyone was very well dressed. People really dressed up for the occasion and I appreciated it.
And a very like embellished vegan cake was there. Like it was had roses and like icing roses and stuff.
It was a vegan, gluten-free cake.
It was delicious.
It was very good. Yeah, Zena Sharman got the cake.
It was delicious.
Hannah McGregor, friend of the podcast, former guest, was one of the editors of Refuse.
She's not gluten-free though. She's just vegan. I don't know what...
I think it was just so that maybe other people.
It's just so everybody could eat it.
Yeah, so it was like a cake that all could enjoy.
I mean, it was delicious.
Unless you don't like pink icing, you're allergic to it for some reason.
If you don't like pink icing,
which I mean, may God have mercy on your soul if that is who you are.
What is wrong with you? If you don't like pink icing.
It's the best.
I don't know whether I should tell you this or not, but I, but I invented a in public outfit which I always wear in public now, and it's based on the colors of my cat.
Whoa, this is exactly the kind of content that we care about.
Tell us about this
well,
outfit.
We got a new old cat, and she is a tortoise shell. It took me a long time to get used to her coloration, which struck me as very odd, because she really looks like a wild animal. But when the sun shines on her, it's very beautiful, this mixture of brown and black, and you know. And I thought, why don't I try and reproduce the colors of my cat in my outfit? So I have a black jacket and pants, and I have the brown belt, and I have a brown T-shirt, and I'm trying to reproduce those tortoiseshell colors.
I love tortoiseshell cats.
This is the best outfit conversation I've had in a very long time.
I love torties. They're so sweet and weird. They're really weird.
They are. Yeah, she's a very weird cat.
They're super weird.
Is that like a thing that they are weird cats?
I think so.
Yeah, I think I've read that they are weird cats.
Yeah, they have strong personalities. Our cat, Chester, who was a female cat but fixed, but her name was Chester, was extremely weird, and she ran sideways, and she had huge ears like a donkey. Aww. She was the cutest.
Well,
and very small.
Our new old cat has abandonment issues. And if we leave, she sits and cries. She just sounds like a person. She goes, oh, oh, oh. And then the latest thing she's taken to doing is when I go to bed, I smooth out everything on the bed so it's all smooth and flat. And then she jumps up there and chases her tail for about 10 minutes. She just goes around like a whirling dervish.
I love it. I love it. I love cats. They're so inappropriate.
I love most animals except for birds.
Oh, yeah. You hate birds.
Oh, I can't with birds.
That's how do you feel about Jonathan Franzen? He loves birds.
That is one of the 78 reasons I dislike Jonathan Franzen.
As a Franzen apologist, I have a lot. No, I don't have anything additional. I just...
People had told me for years I ought to read him. And I always thought, okay, I'll put him on my reading list and I'll read him eventually. And then everything I've been hearing about him in the last couple of years, I think maybe I won't get around to him.
I like his books.
All of them?
I've only read three.
That's most of them.
I read The Corrections. I read Freedom. I read his first essay collection, How to Be Alone. Truthfully, I did not finish Purity. And then I guess he has some new book. I don't know.
I don't know.
Whatever.
I
just... It's fine. I mean, everyone has things that are problematic that they like. This is one of mine.
Oh, there's many things I like that are problematic and it's fine.
Oh, me too. Zillions of things that are problematic.
Yeah, of course. But for some reason, he's like on the shelf for me. But I'm not, I never really defend him. I'm just an apologist.
You can be an apologist for his work and not defend him as a person also, right?
I also just like that he's like kind of a dick and is constantly doing interviews online and then complains about everyone being online all the time. Like, it's so absurd. Yeah. Guess where people are reading this interview with you? On the internet. You completely ridiculous person. Like, that's what's happening.
What do you guys think of Grimes? Speaking of people's...
Grimes?
The one who's dating Elon Musk?
They're not dating anymore.
Oh, did
they
break up?
They're not dating anymore, really?
I don't think so.
I thought they were still.
I was very sad, and I thought...
I don't like it.
You know, it's none of my business who superstars date, but I was very sad when she...
Keith, that's wrong. It definitely is your business. It's all our business.
Why were you sad? What made you sad about it?
Because I think she's an authentic genius. I mean, she's really right up there, and I just loved what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, Elon Musk, what are you thinking? What on earth are you thinking?
Okay, well, she's about 30, I think. Maybe
like
under
that.
30, just
she's,
under.
Just under 30.
She's young,
just under 30. Everybody has one of those partners that everyone says, what were you thinking? And then you move on and you do other things and it's fine. This is how I feel about Grimes
feel
and Elon
like
Musk.
I like the trend of pop stars and musicians dating famous people and then later realizing they should just be dating their backup dancers because that's the right choice. Like, that to me is a good trajectory and I support it. You get to be the star. That man is physically behind you because you're more important. It's great.
And he's just used to it.
Yes.
It's like the Mariah Carey, basically.
This is what I'm saying. Mariah Carey, Britney Spears, these are good choices that they're making going forward.
I feel
Jennifer
like
Lopez.
Britney Spears is dating her trainer.
He's a dancer too.
Yeah, but he was her trainer, I thought.
He's very young.
He's
her Instagram?
Oh, he's like 24.
Extremely pure and beautiful.
Her Instagram, because she does a lot of things like pirouettes on a rock in the Grand Canyon.
And then she'll also like force her sons to pose somewhere and they're like awkwardly like, Mom. And you're just like, this is so great.
Actually, her sons seem very normal.
They're, yeah.
In her Instagrams.
Well, they're not hanging out with Kevin Federline that much, so I think they're fine.
I don't think he's that bad.
I don't either, but I don't know. I don't know him.
I mean, the thing about Britney Spears' Instagram is in the last year or so, she's been really I think, feeling good and feeling healthy.
I think so too.
And I appreciate that. And if this 24-year-old trainer is helping her feel good and feel healthy, and she's being a good mom to her kids, mm-hmm. and she's doing what she loves, then great.
This is all good.
Yes.
And all the, adores her. He really posts about her on his Instagram where he hardly has any followers, and it's super cute.
I mean, good for him.
Yeah.
Okay, so if this is the case, what about the Jennifer Lopez, Alex Rodriguez situation?
I mean, I feel like he's obviously not as great as she is.
I think he knows it.
Of course he does. Like, no offense, being a baseball player is whatever. But being Jennifer Lopez is one of the best things you can be.
Well, he's retired.
Right.
And he's
losing relevance by the minute.
By the minute, whereas she's not even close to being retired.
Correct.
Okay. And I feel like there's so many shots of him at like her concerts where he's filming her just for his own phone.
Yeah.
Oh, and like super into her performances. He just stands there like a fanboy. And I like that. I like that about him.
I like that too.
I mean, I'm into it. Maybe she's finally happy.
I feel like maybe we should be making this a segment because we talk about celebrity relationships all the time.
That's what's happening. What's happening, Dina?
What's happening?
I keep saying to myself, I should not worry about these superstars. There was one point at which I would see Grimes on YouTube and she just played some concert somewhere. And I'd think, you're not eating enough.
Oh, yeah. She's very thin.
You're getting too thin.
These
oh, my goodness.
That we all think.
I think that. I thought that about her. And her hair. So her hair gets bigger when she gets smaller. Have you noticed this?
Oh, my goodness.
Jen, good observation.
No, I mean, I think it's a thing that's like very thin women will do is they'll make their hair bigger in any way you can with, you know, extensions or whatever. And I think it's like a distraction tactic to distract you from their body. Really? I think so.
I believe it.
Yeah. So as she got smaller, her hair got bigger and bigger. But I think she's eating more now.
Good.
Yeah.
Because she needed to.
Grimes, you should listen to our podcast. We only want the best for you.
Yeah, Grimes, we're really on board for you making good choices and taking care of yourself. So what's happening with me is last weekend on Saturday, around this time, I could probably tell you what I was doing. I was at Universal Studios. So last weekend, I went to Los Angeles to visit a friend of the podcast, former host, Daniel Zamparelli.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel. It was Daniel's birthday, and we did a lot of fun things. We ate a lot of things. We drank a lot of things. But on Saturday, we went to Universal Studios, and I hadn't been there in 30 years since I was a child. And it was very different. There's way more stuff. But when we got there, the first thing that we saw were all these signs that said Day of Days. And I was like, what is that? And it was like a special Days of Our Lives celebration that they were having.
No.
And that was one of the soap operas I did watch. So I got really excited. And there was a big sign that said, Welcome to Salem.
Did we not just talk about Days of Our Lives with Wab Geeshik Rice on the last episode?
We talked about Days of Our Lives and General Hospital.
And Young and the Restless.
With Wab, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Young and the Restless. So that was cool, but we didn't wait. There was a huge line for all these people that were going to have a meet and greet, but also there was a podcast about Days of Our Lives that was going to be doing a live taping. But yeah, Universal Studios was great. We had so much fun.
Who was there for the meet and greet?
I didn't really know any of the people that were there for the meet and greet. And again, we didn't never, because it was kind of on the way into the more of the like theme park part. So we didn't actually go into that area again. Because it was like on your way out when you're leaving. So you didn't have to pay to go to that. You had to pay to like go into the Harry Potter world or to go into all the rides and Simpsons world and all of those things.
I mean, this sounds delightful.
It was delightful. Everything was like brightly colored and cute. And I love cheesy things. So it was very exciting for me. I posed with a lot of stuff, which I also like doing.
Is the food good there?
There's a ton of restaurants. I don't know. We just eat like really fast food. So I had, of course, like really fancy ice cream with a bunch of toppings on it because I'm 5, and I had a churro and like a bunch of, a lot of like sweet snacks. But there are a lot of different types of places that you can eat, like way more than before. And all like in this like Harry Potter area, you go in and there's the pub is there and you can go in like into the pub restaurant.
And have like a butterbeer?
Yeah, they have butterbeer, but they also have just like normal beer. But then when you go in the Simpsons world, you go into Moe's Tavern or like Duff Gardens and there's Duff beer and all these different types of beer. And snacks. And yeah, it was extremely enjoyable. And the rides were really fun.
Yeah. The rides are really great.
The rides were really awesome. There also was Walking Dead, like
what
interactive maze?
Oh no, I don't like that at all.
I didn't like it at all.
No, I don't like this idea.
But then after we got out, I was like, I didn't like that, and I was like, but I would do it again.
Is it scary?
There's just a lot of jump scares, which I am not a fan of.
Like people,
there's zombies are like reaching out for you and
like,
stuff.
Like they're actual people.
Mm-hmm, there's actors in there, and they're like coming for you.
No. That's no good.
But then the next day on Sunday, we went to what maybe is now one of my favorite places, La Brea.
The tar pits.
Unbelievable. I was so happy. I almost cried.
Like the dinosaur stuff?
I love megafauna so much. Extinct megafauna are one of my top things that I care about. And it was amazing. The stuff they have there is so beautiful. And the actual museum was gorgeous. And yeah, just outside, the smelly tar everywhere. And there's all these like sculptures. Yeah, so there's the mammoths that are like trapped in the tar when you get there.
Like would Oscar
like right off Wilshire, there's like this huge pit. I think he would like it. Oh yeah, it's super fun.
Yeah.
And then there's like a huge short-faced bear.
A short-faced bear.
Yeah. North American short-faced bear. They're really huge.
Are they extinct? They're all extinct.
Everything is extinct that is there. And there's two different types of ground sloths that are there. Shasta ground sloth, and they have like weird hands that where they kind of walk with their like paws turned in and their long claws just sticking out. Ground sloths are so weird. They don't look anything like modern sloths. They're so weird looking. But right beside it is LACMA, the art museum. And so it was great. It was like two things in one. Super good.
Are you saying the sloths are pigeon toed?
Just that one. Not all sloths are like that.
That's interesting.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I like the idea of a pigeon-toed sloth.
Shasta ground sloth. I wrote a poem about it in my book. So I'm already going to start promoting my book.
It's a big deal.
March 2019. Please purchase it.
Pre-order. Not now. Maybe soon.
I think you can now.
Oh, really?
I think it's going to be there.
Awesome.
Yeah. Dire wolves.
Ooh,
they have a big mammoth. They discovered like a huge mammoth there. So they're still like excavating it and cleaning it up. And yeah, but there's another one that's in the museum. It's very big and beautiful.
I'm glad you had that experience.
I love it so much. I love natural history museums. I would like to live in one.
Maybe you can.
I mean, that's the dream. That's the dream.
You can be the night security guard.
When I was a little kid, we went to Pittsburgh to the museum. And there was a whole reconstructed brontosaurus skeleton that was about 9 years old. And
it's so exciting.
That was the greatest thing I'd ever seen.
It is so great. Last year, I went to the Royal Ontario Museum for the first time. And when you go in, one of the first things that you see is a huge brontosaurus that's like right in the main hall. And then the ceiling goes kind of all the way up so you can see it from every floor. I loved it. Yeah.
So good.
It was so good. But Also, if you ever go to Whitehorse, go to the Beringia Interpretive Center. It's amazing. It's so cool. Lots of mammoths there. But yeah, no dinosaurs. I guess because of when the tar developed. And so, yeah, animals would get stuck in the tar.
It's a good story. Animals getting stuck in tar.
Yeah. And like the dire wolves would then be like, oh, this animal's stuck. I'm going to go try and eat it while it's slowly
dying. And then the wolves.
And then the wolves would get trapped in. So
it's
they were.
It's a chain of life stuck in tar.
It's really awkward.
It's a circle of life.
It is. I can't even. I'm not ready.
I can't do that.
My throat's not ready for.
Not this November.
Elton John.
Nope.
Keith, do you have anything else that's happening with you?
When I was sitting here, what the listening audience did not get to hear is. Dina and Jen trying to record their intro over and over again until they got it, which reminded me of when I first moved here. I was a freelancer for the CBC, and this was back in the days when freelancers cut their own shows, right? And we were using the old brown tape in which you cut it with a razor blade, literally.
Oh, yeah.
And I had gone down to Bellingham and interviewed a bunch of Americans who were really upset about Canadians coming down and buying their land. which is a little bit reversed.
Hello. Right?
I came back up, and the show was due, and I cut it all night long. I started cutting and cutting and cutting. I finished it early in the morning. I had been up all night. My entire apartment was filled with tape. And I went into the CBC studios and was met by my producer, who, when it comes to producing radio, has no sense of humor whatsoever. And we needed to put a tag on the end. And the tag was, I went in the recording room, the light went on, and I said what I was supposed to say. I said, for five nights, this is Keith Millard in Bellingham, Washington. Yeah. Light goes out, I hear his voice coming through the door. It says, don't say Washington. So I say, four or five nights, this is Keith Millard in Bellingham. And I started laughing. And I actually literally fell onto the floor laughing. Long silence. He has no sense of humor. He does not think this is funny. And I swear, I kept trying. And every time I tried, I blew it over and over again. I could not say Bellingham, Washington. And it took about 10 or 15 takes before I said, for five nights, this is Keith Millard in Bellingham, Washington.
Oh, my God.
And that's
God.
What you hear at the end of the show.
You know what, though? My family owns property in Washington.
You Canadians buying up mm-hmm. land?
It was cheaper to buy lakefront property there. So we still have it.
I mean, that's a real problem.
Yeah, we've really caused a lot of problems. You,
the Del Bucchias have caused a lot of problems.
It was
problems.
The Catalanos who bought it.
Oh, sorry. The Catalanos.
Yeah. The Catalano side bought the property, not the Del Bucchias side.
Should we talk about Keith's book, though?
Yeah.
Twin Studies, which is right in front of us.
Twin Studies?
I'm touching it right now.
Yeah.
The listener can't see this, but I'm just patting the cover.
She's patting it. I loved it so much. I blurbed it.
Jen loved it so much she had to blurb it.
Yeah. I love being able to say that.
I love the blurb. It was a good blurb.
It's a good blurb.
I think it's a great blurb.
I feel like I read a good blurb. I don't do them that often. You know what I love about Twin Studies, though, is, and I actually, somebody tweeted this out, and I can't remember who that is, and they'll probably tell us when the podcast goes up, said it takes a real master of writing to be able to make that person root for a West Van mom.
It was
in
it was
yoga
Erica
pants.
Thorkelson.
It was Erica Thorkelson.
I'm
that's
pretty
it.
Sure it was Erica Thorkelson who said that.
And that's exactly what I was thinking about this novel, is that when that novel starts out, I actually don't really like anybody. Like those characters, I was like, ugh, like I don't like these people. And then at some point, there's this like magic alchemy that happens mm-hmm. where all of the characters start interacting more intimately with each other and then thusly showing the reader who they really are and what their thoughts and their emotions are. So my question actually is, what made you center this novel around the West Van mom, the hot West Van mom in the yoga pants?
West Van mom.
Yeah.
We've lived in West Van for years and years and years. And West Van is a really bizarre place. It's a very strange place. My wife grew up in West Van, mm-hmm. which probably originally gave me the idea. And when our second daughter was a baby and then a little kid starting into school, Mary, my wife, had a very demanding downtown job. So I was basically the mom. I did all the driving. I drove to the dance school. I drove to school. I met with the other moms. And so a lot of that experience went into the book. You know, they say, write about what you know about. Well, I know about that. When it comes to the men I met in West Van, I'm exactly like Karen. I cannot even imagine what their day looks like. I met a friend of Liz's dad, and I say, hi, and what do you do? He says, oh, I'm in gold futures.
What does that even mean?
And that's exactly what I thought. What does that even mean? I am in gold future.
It sounds great. If I could live in the gold future, that seems wonderful. There actually isn't a lot of men in the book.
No, there aren't.
There are boys,
they're
but not
boys.
Men. Yeah. There are youths.
In the early draft of the book, there were no men whatsoever. And it finally dawned on me, there's no man in this book.
I mean, it sounds like a dream book.
And then...
that's mean.
Then as the book evolved and the story evolved, then Brian came in and he appeared, the strangest.
Oh, I like Brian.
I like Brian, too.
Brian is the only good man in the book.
I wish he was real.
In my opinion. I do, too.
I like Australians. I like Australians a lot, mm-hmm. All the ones that I met. And also my elder daughter did one of those things where you work in, you know, she went and worked in Australia for however long she was allowed to and came back with many Australian stories. So, and then once I get into something, then I thought, okay, Tasmania is to Australia as West Virginia is to the United States. I'm from West Virginia, therefore I identify with Tasmania. I better find out lots about Tasmania. So I read everything there was to read about Tasmania. And actually, through a colleague, found an informant living in Tasmania, and I would send them all these questions, like, and I would get these enormously detailed answers.
Ooh, that's good, though. That's like a researcher's dream.
It was a researcher's dream, right?
That's true. Well, just speaking about characters, like you were saying, like the character work in this book is, I feel like, very astounding because it takes all of these turns that are unexpected. But then also there are things that just... kind of right away are markers. Like if you tell me that a guy is a super huge snob about scotch, I know that he is a grade A dickwad immediately. Like even before he shows himself, you're like, that guy sucks. Like, so these kind of character choices that seem somewhat innocuous are always kind of indicating something.
Is
else.
That her ex-husband who has the scotch thing?
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. That's yes. Right. Her ex-husband. Yeah. Yes.
Ugh. He is a grade A dickwad. I didn't like him at all.
He's a real grade A dickwad.
It's true. He is.
But there's also, you know, subtler moments that build, kind of like what Jen was talking about. So how did you kind of make these choices about when sort of either these turns would be for the characters, but also for like, I think those were really signals to the reader to be like, oh, you have to pay more attention now, or you have to like understand this person in a different way than you were before.
I'm not sure how I made the choices for any of the particular turns, but the book is in one of two viewpoints, either in Karen's or in Erica's. And Erica actually says at one point, we're not what people see. That's, you know, Karen is about to go out and have dinner, and she's all dressed up, including in the Louboutin boots that
she
bought.
Yeah, her fancy boots.
You described those boots beautifully.
Impulse. Can you imagine buying them on impulse? Do you know what they cost?
I mean, I can't imagine it, and it's so far beyond what is acceptable for me to do.
I mean, it's more than my mortgage payment, I'm sure.
I would
expensive.
Love to do that.
Now, absolute sidebar here. In the last year, seeing as I'm now conscious of Louboutins, and you can see them from a mile away because of the red soles.
They're showing you the money they spent.
That's right. You know, those red soles are copyrighted. Mm-hmm. I have seen not one, not two, three women in the Caulfield Mall wearing Louboutins in the last year.
Just parading around the mall.
Right. This is West Vancouver.
I have a good friend who lives down the street. She's a North Burnaby mom, and she has two pairs of Louboutins and two pairs of Yves Saint Laurent Rockstar stud heels. And she doesn't make, she's a hairstylist. She doesn't make that much money, but she saves her money for that stuff.
Yeah, well, viewed from some angle, they're collector's items from some angle. Right?
But I think that, shoe collecting has always existed, but I think, I'm just going to say it, Sex and the City really fucked people up. In terms of like...
For the really expensive...
Yeah. For like, you know, seeing a character make these choices and being like, I want to be like that. I want to save up for these Manola Blahniks. I want to do...
Yeah. Her apartment's the size of a broom closet, but she's
got... But it's full of the most expensive shoes that you can purchase. Yeah.
I mean, Karen is... Actually, I was going to ask about research, and because one of the funny things about, I have so many Keith Millard stories, but one of my Keith Millard stories is when I was your student and we had a meeting in your office and you had two full bookshelves full of Vogue magazines from like the 50s and 60s. And that was when you were researching Gloria, and which is set in that time. And then the main character is like a fancy sort of debutante young woman. So these Vogue magazines were, of course, like research, but you had a lot of them.
Like, I did. I had two whole shelves of them. When I changed offices two summers ago, it was a student of mine who had graduated, so she was no longer a student. And I said, I need some help, and I will pay you lots of money. And she said, okay. So she was helping me pack up my office, and we were trying to find some place that would take the Vogues. Nobody wanted the Vogues. Oh.
That is really sad.
That is really sad. And she looked at me and she said, can I take the one from the month when I was born?
Oh, that's sweet.
And I said, sure. And then I thought, the month when she was born? How old am I?
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, I'm curious because you said you got all this like detailed stuff about Tasmania and we're reading so much about Tasmania. And I started thinking, so is research for you like a immersion into something?
Yes. It is a total, with a major character, I want to get as immersed as I possibly can get. So yes. When I read about the lengths to which Mary Lee Settle would go when she was researching stuff, I recognized a fellow spirit. She has a character who's crossing from Virginia into West Virginia back in the 18th century. And as they would do, mountain lions came and slept with her at night for the warmth.
Really? And there was no like conflict? No.
No, they just come and snuggle up to you as long as you don't freak out.
Oh.
So in order to research that, Mary Lee bribed a zookeeper in London to let her go into the cage with the mountain lion.
Whoa.
And I thought, I understand where she's coming from. I know what that feeling is. Yeah, I like to get totally immersed in my various characters, sure.
But there's so many things that the characters are... there are characters also in the book who have obsessions.
Yes,
which is also interesting. So there's like this parallel of the writer being like, I have to be immersed. And then there are characters in the book kind of reflecting that level of interest, obsession, immersion. And so were you thinking about that at all? Like the way we sometimes, not that you're putting yourself into the book, but that the way we sometimes are trying to reflect sort of that, the emotionality of that.
Oh, yeah. I don't know quite who you're thinking of, but if you mean the twins.
Well, the twins for sure, but also, Erica. I mean, Erica is,
the driving,
because of her own, the driving.
The OCD
but
driving
but also
she
just
does.
By being a twin and, you know, then going on to study that as, you know. Like, to me, those, the sets of twins and Erica all live in kind of this, and they're all the twin characters have this kind of obsessive world that they exist
live in the
within.
The twin bubble, yeah.
Yeah.
I read lots about
Twins. I bet you did.
Oh, my goodness. Did
How many times did you watch Twins? The movie Twins, though?
Are you talking about the Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito movie?
Is there another movie called Twins?
Actually, I didn't watch that, but I watched both Parent Traps.
I could tell from
several
the book.
Times.
I love the Parent Trap.
I do, too.
It's Haley Mills, right?
Mills. The Haley Mills one is better. But
it's so good.
The other one isn't bad, but the Haley Mills one is kind of classy.
Yeah. Like the twin thing is interesting to me because I have friends who are parents of twins, which is more and more common, I think, because of fertility treatments and such and people having children when they're older. When I was reading your book, I'm like, oh, are they going to become like this? Like weirdly obsessive about stuff, like have, or not even that so much, but have their own world, you know, and their own language and their own.
Well, there are different kinds of what we call identical MZ twins. There are different kinds of identical twins. And early twin researchers tried to find different categories to put them in. Some of them are not bonded in that, you know, intense way. And some of them actually don't get along.
Really?
Yeah. You get most human traits have a strong element of heritability. Okay. You get a set of identicals who are both highly competitive. They'll compete with each other.
Right.
And, you know, really don't get along and don't like each other that much, but are still attached in some sort of way. But then there are other kinds of twins who are really highly bonded. The most highly bonded twins have trouble separating. And that's the one set of twins I have in my book are like that. The early researchers called them unit identity twins, which they see themselves as a single unit.
Right. They don't see identities separate from each other.
Right.
It reminds me of, and actually when I was reading twin studies, I saw this story on people.com about a set of identical twins marrying a set of identical twins and how all four of them were going to live together. And I'm like, oh, it's just like Facebook.
Well, actually, there have been a number of instances of that. And the one case I remember is, yeah, a set of identical twins married a set of identical twins, and they bought two houses right next to each other and had a bunch of kids who sort of flow back and forth between the two houses. And they're all, of course, you know, related.
But the kids are like siblings, aren't they? As opposed to cousins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Genetically.
Genetically.
Wow, man. That's a whole other world.
It is.
Like, I fascinating.
Yep.
Fascinating. I would have read about twins for months, which I'm sure you actually did.
Well, and there's also that whole thing where, I mean, where, yeah, some people are really weirded out by twins.
Yeah.
Like there's this there's this like strange revulsion.
There are people that find highly bonded identical twins uncanny or, you know, a little disturbing. I don't want to identify the twins I interviewed, but there was one set of twins I interviewed that I never could quite remember which one I was talking to.
See, that happens because most sets of identical twins, you can tell them apart after a while. There's something, you know, whether one's slightly taller or something.
Yeah.
But I think there are some sets where you really can't.
This particular set... It would have been easier had I seen them together, but I kept running into them separately. And I would say, now, which one is that?
Oh, right. You had to just know from
that
straight visual. Oof. Well, speaking of people living in each other's homes and sharing space, in addition to kind of exploring this very specific bond between twins, you also are really looking at different types of relationships that exist in the world. And I don't know, I kind of like different types of love and affection that people show for each other. And I'm personally really fascinated with that. Like I'm fascinated with any types of relationships that separate us from like this heteronormative expectation where you look at two people together and the expectation is if they are read as a man and a woman, they're obviously fucking, which is so boring. Like I'm so bored of it. Was that part of the initial exploration for you in looking at these characters? Like, what types of connections are people making in the world?
Yes, absolutely. And there's a phrase that has been kicked around forever in our culture, and that is nuclear family.
Yeah.
Okay, folks. A nuclear family is some kids and some adults to look after the kids. That's what a nuclear family is. Nuclear family is not mom, dad, kid, like, you know, 1955, right?
Yeah.
And I think in the last census in the United States, there are more non-traditional families than nuclear ones. I'm not absolutely sure of that statistic, but I think it is... It is really a good thing, you know, a healthy, positive, good thing that we're finding different ways to organize our social relations.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And even just our living situations. Like, I mean, I'm probably 2 years away from sleeping in a dog's bed in Jen's house. If
you're welcome to it.
If the housing market continues. So, I mean, we'll see what happens. Rosie and I are going to share a bed. But on that level as well, like the polarization of... So these people in this... book are wealthy, But there are lots of other, except for one character. But yeah, like it's, you know, the economic part of it as well plays a huge part in like the choices that people are making and the bonds that they're forming and, you know, who they're choosing to take care of. And caretaking in this book, I think, also takes on a huge amount of time. There's one, Karen, I feel like, is doing so much. I kept being like, no, I'm really worried about you, Karen. You can't be caretaking for all these people. This is very stressful.
She had a super full house full of people who needed her attention.
And she also was like not really dealing with her own self. And I'm always felt that so part, worried actually. About that. Me too. I was like, oh, God, why do I always want to take care of a million people? I don't even have any of my own kids.
Yeah, she's bought into the sort of mom myth.
Yeah.
And at one point, she's trying to be everybody's mom.
It kind of explodes in her face in a way where she's like, yeah, she can't escape caretaking at all.
But yeah, the bond she forms with Erica is a non-traditional bond.
It is.
It's quite beautiful, actually, their bond. Is. Yeah.
I've known a lot of women that who told me about growing up in their adolescence, and so many of them had a really good girlfriend.
Yes.
And, or several.
Or several. And I always say, you know, where did she go? And sometimes they don't even know.
Oh, that makes me sad.
It is. Yeah, it does. You know, it makes me sad too. And those bonds are important. There's a, when I was doing all the research in the Japanese anime manga stuff, right, which I did for the younger set of twins, there's a group of four women in Japan, and they call themselves Clamp, C-L-A-M-P, and they did what a lot of girls talk about doing but don't do. They started drawing all together in high school, and rather than separating, they just stayed together. And now they all live together in a big house in Tokyo somewhere.
That's a dream.
That is a dream.
Oh, we need to do that.
We will in this condo.
In this condo, because everyone will be renovated.
Yeah, we're all going to live here. I'm going to get renovated a couple more times for sure.
I mean, what we'll do is we'll just subdivide the bedroom. It'll be fine.
I'm fine with it. I think the importance that we can put on friendships is more important than people want to give it credit for. Like when someone's marriage breaks up.
For example. You know, I don't know anything about example, such things.
For example.
No, nobody knows anything yeah. about those things.
Right? But I mean, it wasn't like you were going to immediately like another man. You
oh,
were
God,
like,
no.
These are the people that have already formed my support system around me. Or when things fall apart, like in the book. And that's why I think Erica and Karen could have such a deep relationship, because both of them were going through different things that they could only talk to with this other person.
Right.
Yeah.
It's quite lovely, those two
it
together.
It was really cute.
It was super lovely.
Yeah, I really like them.
Do we want to talk
How many about- times did you go to Medicine Hat? Just kidding.
Yeah, did you go to Medicine Hat?
Yes, I did.
I want to know!
Of course I went to Medicine Hat. Of course I went to
How
Medicine
was it?
Hat. I really like Medicine Hat. The first time I went to Medicine Hat, I flew to Calgary and then took the little itty-bitty plane that goes from Calgary to Medicine Hat that costs more than the flight from Vancouver to Calgary.
What kind of a plane is it? Is it like a Twin Otter? Is it a Dash 8?
I don't know what kind it is, but it looked to me like a school bus with wings on it.
Okay.
Anyhow, I got on the tiny plane, and I tried to put myself in this mental state, and it went like this. I said, see, I've never been to Medicine Hat, and I don't even know Alberta that much. I've been to Calgary and Edmonton, but this is to visit. And I sat there and I thought, I'm going home. Medicine Hat is my home. I am going home. And I got off the plane, and I tried to look at everything that way. I grew up here. These are my people. This is because I wanted to be in Erica's head, right? And luckily, the people I was staying with were very helpful. And they said, oh, okay, you want to, you know, Medicine Hat. They took me everywhere there was to see in Medicine Hat. We drove around. We actually picked out Erica's parents' house. Said, oh, yeah, that's where they live. That's right. Okay. And so I tried to do that kind of immersion in Medicine Hat when I was there. So I really like Medicine. I mean, how could I not like Medicine? That was my home.
Yeah, it was your home. That's not true. Some people don't like their home. They have complicated feelings.
That's true. There are complicated feelings.
So what would you call this method writing as you like get into the
that's
character?
A good phrase.
I'm just saying that's what it felt like to me, like with thinking about acting.
Because this is far more research than like say I would do for a novel. I'm a very lazy researcher, but yeah.
I mean, same. Unless I'm researching megafauna for a poem, and then for one poem, we'll read like a bunch of books.
I hadn't thought of it as method writing, but yeah, it's very similar to the method. Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Because I love geographic research because I believe personally, and I've said this to my students many times, is that it's really hard to write a place unless you know it intimately, unless you know what the footsteps are to get to this place and how long it takes and whether it's an incline or whatever. But like, yeah, I think you're far more immersive than I am.
Totally.
I just write about Vancouver all the time. Works for me.
But, you know, I have to know things like, where do you go for coffee in Medicine Hat? You go to Timmy Hortons. That's the only choice you got.
That's where you
got
to go.
That's where you got to go.
Get your double-double.
I like a double-double.
Do you?
I like an ice cap, actually. That's my favorite.
As a non-coffee drinker, I love hearing about what people like to drink.
I like Timmy's.
Great.
I mean, I'm cool with that.
I like donuts, as has been discussed.
Many times.
Many times. Maybe too many times.
But you've got to stand and look at that. It isn't dead flat.
Is it dead flat? Like it's parts not, of
no, it isn't dead no. flat. There's rolling hills.
Yeah.
But it's compared to where we are now, it's sort of flat. Mm-hmm. And you can stand and you can turn and you can see that huge sky all the way around you.
Isn't that something though?
Yeah, it really is.
Sunrise and sunset are really something.
And then I thought, okay, that's the landscape of home. Then Vancouver's going to look really strange. All those mountains sitting there looking at you. Yeah.
And the ocean and the mountains coming together, yeah.
People from the prairies have often said to me when they're in Vancouver, they feel oppressed by the landscape.
I've had low the same clouds, experience, yeah.
Looming mountains, and they feel like they're people being like that. Suffocated.
Yeah. Were you looking at me?
Yeah, I'm looking at you. Dina Del Bucchia.
Do you want me to ask more questions?
Yeah, do you? Well, I was going to say, do we want to talk about Refuse, the
okay,
book?
Okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah, about your essay in Refuse, which just was launched like 3 days ago.
How do you feel about being in this collection?
Yeah, how do you feel about it?
I feel like I'm in really good company. The great thing about Refuse, which is was pointed out by one of the other contributors, is how different all the essays are.
Some of them are not essays. Some of them are poems.
Some of them are not essays. There is not a unified point of view. There are diverse points of view, sometimes in conflict with each other. One of the contributors described the book as messy, and it is. And that's the strength of it. I think that's what literature should have. It should have this energy, this mess.
Well, I think what the editors have done is they have acknowledged the academic value of things like social media, mm-hmm. of different forms of writing. And they've incorporated that into the format or the structure of the book,
yes.
which I think is really smart and really speaks to where we're at, because so much of what Refuse is about is like, I guess I don't like the word social justice, but it's about social justice. And so much of that happens in social media or in other forms. So I think what Hannah McGregor, Julie Rack, and Aaron Wunker,
editors.
Friends of the podcast, some the former
editors,
guests.
The editors of the book,
Editors of the book, have very smartly done. And it's actually tied together, I think, the diverse points of view really well, because all of these people take their activism or whatever you want to call it in different formats.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's my hot take.
I love that take. I think it's great. Shut it down.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. I'm not in charge. That's always
Nobody's
important to remember.
In charge.
Yeah.
No,
I meant even
horizontal.
As a podcast, I'm not in charge. It's all over the place.
It's one of my most famous quotes. Power is horizontal. Or should be.
Yeah. It should be. Mm-hmm. Ugh. It really should be. Because in your essay, you talk about a writer, W.P. Kinsella, who was writing what we would now call appropriative literature of the parlance
and
of our
totally,
times.
And was totally, absolutely unapologetic
about
it.
Totally, yeah. And he was like, no, that's what's great about it. Like, I don't know anything about what I'm talking
totally
about.
It's totally fiction. No, I would never visit the reserves that I'm writing about. I don't want to be confused with facts. I'm writing fiction.
Yeah.
He was absolutely, totally unabashed. Right. Yeah.
Which, again, there was a parallel to last year during the appropriation prize controversy, which is also addressed in Refused. And this idea that and the book is really clear about that. It's like, we can't act like things have changed in this huge way and everyone is woke and amazing and we're all doing so great, because there's still so many issues that have never been addressed.
Well, I think this is what was so great about Keith's essay in particular, is the drawing of lines between what has always been happening and what is happening.
And the breadth of that.
Yeah. So what do you think is the difference today as opposed to what was happening like 20 years ago or 30 years ago?
It's still going on, but the big difference is it didn't cross anybody's mind a million years ago that there was anything wrong anywhere. At least a bunch of people now know that there's something wrong with this, right? It's like, you know, when I was growing up in the 50s and listened to the radio, there was Amos and Andy. And, you know, we all listened to Amos and Andy and thought it was really funny. And that's a show written by white people starring white actors pretending to be black people. And, you know, we all laughed at it. But the pernicious thing is, at some level in your head, if you listened to Amos and Andy a lot, you thought that's the way black people were. Okay. And there are Canadians who think that Indigenous people are like the characters in Kinsella's novels, and they're not. Was I into Bakhtin when you studied with me? I can't remember. M.M. Bakhtin is this Russian theoretician who arguably has written the most interesting stuff about fiction, right? Discourse in the novel. In the Soviet system, there was a sort of covert network where the important thing was who you knew, as opposed to the official lie, the official statement, right? Luckily, he knew somebody on the Central Committee, so rather than getting just simply disappeared or shipped to some absolutely ghastly place where he would have died because his health wasn't that good, they sent him to Saransk in Kazakhstan, where he taught in this stupid little teacher's college for a million years. Bakhtin was very careful not to endorse any kind of groupthink, right? But at the same time, his writings about collective action are very positive. So where does collective action start? To Bakhtin, that is a very personal one-on-one thing. And with a writer, the writer meets the reader in this zone outside the book called the reader-writer zone. And in the Bakhtinian encounter, the dialogue between the reader and the writer leaves the reader changed and humbled. And that's why voices of people who've been marginalized are so important, right? If those voices are silenced, we can't encounter them. We can't have dialogue with them, and we can't experience that change, and we can't learn anything, right? And we don't need some white guy pretending to be an Indigenous person. We need a real Indigenous person talking about themselves. That's who we need to encounter, because if we don't, we will stay ignorant. I'm using ignorant in the Buddhist sense, right? That's what, you know, the Buddha said is, you know, the Buddha didn't talk about sin. He talked about ignorance.
Are you subtweeting someone right now by talking about ignorance? No, I'm joking.
Every podcast is a subtweet.
Every podcast is a subtweet. Every tweet is a subtweet.
Honestly, it's all true. Every text I sent to Jen is a subtweet.
Oh,
well,
wow.
You know, again, that Bakhtinian thing. Every word has been somewhere. It has strings attached to it. It's changing. And every utterance is ideological in the Bakhtinian sense. Nobody is without politics.
Oh, yeah.
That's true. Nobody is without politics.
Yeah, for sure.
People who say they're apolitical are liars.
They're people that don't want to care about anyone else. And they want to stay comfortable. Like, so much of it is just about wanting to stay comfortable, I think. And
you don't want to be disturbed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, things are going great for me.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't mess it up. Quit messing with my chill lifestyle. Jen.
Dina.
Do you want to go first?
I can go first.
Okay. So it's now time for Jen's emotion corner, where Jen will be emotional for 1 minute.
Exactly one.
Okay. Jen, you may begin.
Okay. So I've been really sick. I've had this terrible cold, which what happened was yesterday I was lying in bed feeling sorry for myself and like crying because there's this thing about being a single mom, which is that there are so many moving parts to my life that everything is scheduled. If one thing goes wrong, like this terrible cold, then everything is in disarray. And I was lying there crying and I realized then that when I'm sick, there's nobody to pick up the slack. Like there's no one to do the laundry or walk the dog, or finish writing that book I'm under contract for that I'm not going to tell you about because I don't want to jinx anything up. So I'm lying in bed and feeling alone. And it's not that I am alone because I have lots of friends and lots of family, but then as a single parent, there's this like black hole at night that you experience after your child goes to bed, where all the sadness and the sorry for myself feelings kind of descend, and particularly when I'm sick. So I'm wallowing in self-pity for the month of November. And like, I'm not sorry about that. I'm not going to apologize for that. Self-pity is the way it goes.
No apologies.
No, no apologies.
That was perfect.
Thank you. Next. No. Dina's rage minute is coming.
Okay, hold on.
The only thing I ever time on this phone, so that's why it's always set at 1 minute.
I time a lot of things, so I always have to change my timer.
Are you ready?
Are you ready?
I think I'm ready.
Okay.
Okay, go.
Okay. People with money who are cheap, I see you and I judge you. People with money who complain about having money, I see you and I feel very vindictive. People who constantly center themselves when it's not even about them, I see you and I feel exhausted and very angry. Short winter coats. If it doesn't cover my butt, what is even the point? Speaking of, the colors of practical winter gear. Would it kill someone to do a fucking fun floral or a lipstick print parka? It also would help to be seen in the dark. Think about it. That's just a very practical choice. Not boring navy. The shower in my apartment. I have not had a good shower since being rent evicted, and I'm putting a lot of anger and resentment into the shower. Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, all of this unregulated bullshit. Stop it. Go away. Here's the thing. People deserve transportation and housing, and you're fucking ruining it. Great. Perfect timing. That's all I have to say.
I'm with you on the short winter coat.
It's garbage.
It needs to cover your butt.
I just want to be warm. I'm a huge wimp, and I need to be covered up.
There was a point at which both my girls were still in high school, and the fashion was to show a little stripe of flesh.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It used to drive me crazy.
You're like, don't you want...
The rain's coming down. It's the middle of the winter. It's absolutely miserable, and I'm seeing this little ring of exposed flesh.
Yeah. I mean, again, when you're a teen, though, like I definitely...
I don't think they ever get cold.
I grew up in the snow. I was like, no, I only want to wear my Converse to school. I'm never going to wear boots. I'm going to wear this really thin jacket. Like, I just wanted to look cute.
I mean, I had a giant party.
I would like straight up wear a slip to school because I wanted to look like Courtney Love. And then I got sent to the principal's office.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm.
For wearing a slip to school?
Yeah. He was like, you're not allowed to do that again. And I'm like... I get straight A's is what I said. That was my answer. I was like, this isn't affecting my learning. I was really mad. Anyway, I did behave after that.
I got sent to the principal's office once in high school because I wouldn't rat out who had done our graduation prank, which
was your prank?
Some kids in the school took like hedge trimmers and they trimmed the cedar hedge to say grad 94.
What? That's great.
Yeah, it's not so bad. And then they like changed the, I went to Eric Hamber secondary and they changed the letters on the front of the school to say grad 94 yet again. And then they stuck a toilet up there on the roof, which I don't really know how they got it up there. It wasn't that bad. Like they didn't set fire to anything. But then I was editor of the yearbook. Cause of course I was. Mm-hmm. And the principal thought he could like shake me down. to like tell him who did it. And I'm like, I don't know who did it, which is the truth. I really actually, I mean, I did, but I wasn't there when it happened. It was all hearsay.
I even find it weird that the grad prank always involves destroying something at your schools lately.
It was just a toilet on the roof. I mean, honestly.
Toilet on the roof is really funny to me. You know, I mean, I love all toilet jokes, so it's good to me.
I went to an all-boys military school.
Oh no, that Keith. That must have been really fun.
And I, well, actually.
I'm sure there were fun things.
There were fun things. And I got called into the principal's office at one point because they were worrying about my... I'm not even sure what they were worrying about. But we had this rather complicated conversation with the principal. Eventually, he asked me if I had any faith.
In what?
Well, God? If somebody in West Virginia says, do you have any faith? You know what they mean.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, does Jesus dance on your soul? And you're like, well, I don't know.
And I said, I'm 16. You have to understand this. I'm 16. I said, I am a Zen Buddhist.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
And the principal said, my lord, you're on the lunatic fringe.
Oh. Is that the only time anyone's ever said that you're on the lunatic fringe?
They may have thought it, but I think it's the only time anybody put it into words that clearly.
It was articulated in your presence.
Yes.
That's my goal from now on, to have someone tell me I'm on the lunatic fringe.
I agree. I also want that. That's a good club. That's a band name.
The Lunatic.
You like only play small clubs. Lunatic Fringe.
Yeah.
And everyone has obviously has to have bangs.
Well, obviously.
If you're the Lunatic Fringe, you have to have like a very, like a thick bang. It's almost in your eyes. So Keith, where can people find you on the internet if you want them to find you?
Oh, I have a website, which is keithmillard.com.
Beautiful.
It's easy. If you can spell my name right, you can find me on the internet.
If they're listening, they'll see your name printed out. So
and it's a French name, not an English name. So it has an I in it. M-A-I-L-L-A-R-D.
Keith is spelled the usual way.
Keith is spelled the usual way.
All right. You can find us at cantlit.ca, on Facebook at cantlit. You can find us on Twitter at CantLit. We welcome all ratings and reviews from wherever you listen to podcasts. We haven't really had any new reviews, but we would love some.
We love ratings that are 5 stars.
Yeah. Jen said it best. We love a 5-star rating. It really boosts us.
Please write a review and give us a 5-star rating.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So
definitely give them a 5-star rating.
Thank you, Keith. Yay. Keith, we only have one question for you now. It is, what can't you with?
A lot of people say things like kale.
I have a really stupid affliction. I have some serious afflictions, but I don't want to talk about them. But I have a really stupid affliction, which is I have what my doctor diagnosed, and I looked it up on the net, and he's absolutely right. It's called trigger finger. And that is, I have one finger that if I make a clenching motion too tight, it locks.
Oh, my.
Like a claw?
Like a claw.
What? Right?
And then I have to run hot water on it and straighten it out, and it makes a little pop, because pop, and it really hurts.
Sounds bad.
That's sounds really annoying.
Yeah, it sounds
really
terrible.
Really annoying. And I'm going to have to see a... plastic surgeon who goes in and finds the root of the tendon, and there's a little growth on it, and he's going to shave it down and it will go away.
Whoa. Plastic surgeons do so much.
I had no idea that was even such a thing.
I didn't either until it happened to me. I went in to see my doctor and he said, oh, you have trigger finger. I said, I never heard of it. He says, wait a minute. And he went and printed it off the sheet on it.
So you could see it.
So I could see it. It was even a little diagram of the finger with the tendon and everything.
I love a medical diagram.
Yeah. I love it when doctors like print off that one sheet from some medical textbook.
I love any scientific diagram. I'm just, why? Who knows?
Because they're great.
They are great.
They're informative, educational.
I just like the idea that an artist does that. Mm-hmm. Like, that is an artistic practice, and I love it that it exists.
Yeah, someone actually drew,
yeah.
You know, this little diagram.
Right? Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to talk any more about drawings of extinct megafauna. I'll save that for a different episode because I have a lot to say. It's unrelated.
That feels like a Christmas situation.
Oh, maybe we can.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being our guest, Keith.
Thank you, Keith.
Well, thank you for having me.
This was
it's been great.
Such a delight. All right. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.